I want to outline historically what has been building for quite some time now in the way of a black resistance movement. As Americans, we tend not to know much about a situation like this until it kind of blows up. And then suddenly we get concerned. We say, how can this revolution so quickly have taken place? I mean, the Iranian Revolution, for example. As far as we were concerned, that was a spontaneous, sudden kind of an event. Because we had no background, we didn't realize that, in fact, this kind of resistance had been growing for some time in Iran. Now, in South Africa, as blacks begin to, as their revolution begins to make news here, a very common concern of ours is, why are they taking up guns? Because we believe that that is not the best way to seek change. And so we're often critical of Africans for taking up guns through guerrilla war to change our situation. But we, I believe, can only, we have that criticism without any sense of what history blacks may have engaged in to try and change their situation peacefully or legally before they turned to guns. And that's some of what I want to talk about this morning. How did black resistance get started in the 20th century, and what various methods of seeking change have blacks tried to use before they started taking up guns? Now, if you, John, you were there Monday night, weren't you, when we talked about the history?
Yeah.
For those of you who were in on the history of South Africa Monday night, you know that South Africa did not become one united country until about 1910. For example, you had the Cape Colony, the Natal Colony, the Orange Free State, and the South African Republic. Those were two Afrikaans countries and two British colonies.
The South African Republic, the same thing as the Transvaal?
Yeah. Okay. Later, it was, when it was an Afrikaans Republic, it was the South African Republic. Now today it's the Transvaal province of South Africa. We had two Afrikaans countries and two British colonies, and they went to war against each other in 1900. The British won the war. The British went to war against them because the largest gold deposits in the world are found up in this country here, and the British were kind of interested in that. Also diamonds down here. Anyway, after that war, the British consolidated this whole area into the Union of South Africa in 1910. Now, prior to that point, there was no unity among blacks who were trying to seek change. The blacks had been oppressed in South Africa for a lot longer than that. It goes way back from the earliest coming of the whites, that blacks were not treated very well. But they were treated differently in each of these four areas. And so as a result, because these four areas were each kind of a separated country or separated province, blacks were not united throughout the region. You get that point? Up until 1910, any kind of black protest was within one of these areas and it didn't link up together.
Would it also be related to tribal differences too?
That's another factor inhibiting them. Black unity, which to a certain degree is still a problem today, although there's been a great deal of progress made on that in South Africa, and certainly more progress made on that in South Africa than in other African countries, some other African countries. So a key date for the beginning of our focus this morning is 1910. 1910 is when union occurred in South Africa, the Union of South Africa took place. Now prior to 1910, the missionaries played an important role in black protests, because the missionaries always taught the African people not to be too concerned about their situation. The missionaries said, well, we know local whites are racist, and there are problems with that. But the missionaries always said, before 1910, they said, but remember that ultimately the authority here is the Queen of England. The Queen of England is who's running the show. And we missionaries have got a direct line to her, and we know that she's on your side. She's a good, moral, upstanding Christian woman. So don't be too concerned about how the local whites treat you, because ultimately the Queen is in power, and that's what's important. And we missionaries will help you out to make sure that the Queen does a good job in representing your interests. Well, in 1910, the Queen signed away her right to South Africa and made South Africa into a union and a self-governing state. So after that point, Africans started to get more concerned and decided that they needed to start talking with the local white population about how they didn't think the situation was a fair one. So in 1912, an organization was born called the African National Congress, which is today one of the two main, well, it is the major guerrilla organization operating in relation to South Africa today. But when it started out in 1912, their policy was a twofold policy. They said, we, having been trained by the missionaries that violence is not a very good technique to use, and that there are, according to the methods of civilized cultures, there are better ways to seek change, we believe that our policy should be a legal and a nonviolent policy. So this organization, which is today a major guerrilla organization, was in its origin a group that was committed to legal and nonviolent ways of seeking change. They said, we believe that the whites who have taught us that we shouldn't be violent, who have taught us to try and peacefully negotiate any kind of concerns we have, we believe in their integrity. And we believe that if we show them that we have risen up to their way of doing things now and that we can peacefully sit down and point out to him that we, for example, what we'll do is we'll send a delegation to the government, and we'll send a delegation of university graduates, blacks, who have a university degree, maybe a PhD, black. And there were some in 1912 in South Africa. We'll send somebody like that to the government, and we'll have him say to the government, look, here I am, I have a PhD from a university, and I still don't have the right to vote. And we believe that if we peacefully point this out to the government, they will see that this isn't right. That here they've got whites in the country who have an eighth grade education, who have the right to vote, and a black with a PhD doesn't have the right to vote. So we believe that if we seek these methods of negotiation, the whites will see that our situation needs to be improved and they'll come around. And from 1912 until 1939, this was the policy of the African National Congress. And they lived up to it. And they tried a number of different negotiation tactics, but always operating peacefully and legally. And then in 1939, sorry.
Weren't the world wars getting in their way too? Because wasn't Britain more, well, I guess the Queen had let go of them, right? So they didn't have anything to do with any of that?
Well, no, South Africa did participate on the side of the British in World War I and World War II. And blacks played a certain role in that. Yeah, the World Wars kind of focused concern more on Europe and took people's minds off of their situation at home to a certain extent. It was not 1937. It was a 37-year period between 1912 and 1949. For 37 years, Africans tried this policy through the African National Congress. And then in 1949, they said, well, let's evaluate our situation. Let's see how this is working out. Because some people were a little concerned that in 1912, there were a few blacks who had the right to vote. Not very many, but there were a few. But by 1949, no blacks in South Africa had the right to vote anymore. And they said in 1912, there were a few blacks who could own land, be property owners. But by 1949, all blacks have been denied the right to own any land. So there was some concern when they evaluated their strategy in 1949 that this peaceful legal strategy was going backwards, not forwards. They were worse off in 49 than they were in 1912. And what's more, in 1948, the year before they held this evaluation session, the Afrikaners had come to power. Remember, I mentioned the elections of 1948 at the beginning, in the introduction, and indicated that in 1948, when the Afrikaners came to power, that was the beginning of the apartheid laws. And that the government had run on this platform, and so black people were pretty concerned. that in 1949, it looked like their situation was getting worse and worse, not improving. And 37 years was a long time to be patient in looking for some changes. So they decided in 1949 that they better change their tactics. And what they did was to decide that they would keep their commitment to nonviolence, but drop their commitment to legal activity. Because they said, one of the problems in South Africa, and it continues to be a problem today, is that white people think we're happy. The whites in South Africa believe very deeply that blacks in South Africa appreciate the kind of system which whites have given them. Shows you how out of touch white South Africans are with black South Africans, but it happens. It happens in many parts of the world, not the least of which is our own country, I think. Some of the things that white South Africans say about how happy black South Africans are with their system sound awful familiar to me to the way Americans talk about what a good system we have for our allies around the world, in the third world. We tend to think that the third world countries are well off if they're with us. Whereas if we were to go to the third world and to talk to some of those people in Latin America or Africa, we might find out that in fact they're a little bit critical of our system.
It makes me think also of the attitudes toward, I think more specifically blacks in this country, but other minority groups also, under slavery and also since then. I think about the happy slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And other things since then too.
Mm-hmm. And the important thing is not whether or not people really are happy. The important thing is that we hold these opinions even though we haven't directly talked to the people that we think are happy. And that's what's going on in South Africa. That whites, because they were so isolated from blacks, it was easy for them to think that blacks were happy. So blacks said, we've tried to tell them otherwise legally, and it hasn't worked. Our voice has never been heard. So maybe it's necessary that we break the law as a way of getting their attention. However, we will still be nonviolent, because that's a very important thing to us, to try and seek changes nonviolently, peacefully. So you had, during the 1950s, as a result of this policy change, you had a period of what we call civil disobedience, whereby blacks said, we will disobey civilly, peacefully. We're going to disobey certain laws that we think are unjust, laws which discriminate against us as a people, and which therefore are racist laws, and we don't think that they're just in the first place, and we will peacefully disobey these laws, and in the course of doing that, we'll be breaking the law, and when we break the law, we'll get some publicity for our cause. And that publicity will help to convince the whites that our situation is not, that we're not satisfied with our situation, and then maybe the whites will change, because they'll no longer be able to believe that we're so happy with the laws that they're giving us. Now, in particular, during the 1950s, the laws which were focused on, more than any other laws, were the PASS laws. I'm showing some films. Have any of you seen the films in the village this week, last week? White Lager and Generations of Resistance? Well, White Lager isn't scheduled to be shown again, but Generations of Resistance is. And it talks about, that will be shown Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And that talks about these PASS laws. The PASS laws in South Africa require that a black person, it's part of the apartheid laws, and it requires that every black person, if you look at a map of the country, there are certain regions, black reservations scattered around the country. They're about 13% of the land. And the government, the whites would like to think that all blacks live in the reservation. Now, in fact, only about a third of them live there. And the government says any black person who comes out of the reservation, or which as far as the government is concerned, is all black people who are not living in the reservations, but are living in white South Africa, 87% of the land, must carry a pass on them. 24 hours a day, they have to have a pass which is signed by an employer, which proves that they have a job. Because whites said, the only way we want blacks to be in white South Africa is if they're working for us. if they're here to work for us, then it's okay. But if they're here working for us, they should have an employer, and the employer should sign their document every week indicating that they have a job here. And if a black person doesn't have such a pass, then they should be sent to jail or shipped back to the reservation. Now, whites are free to go where they please. You know, they don't have to have a pass to be in a given city. So black people said, here we have an example of racist laws. Because blacks have to carry these passes, and it restricts our mobility. Whites don't have to carry these passes, and so this is unfair. This is racism. And blacks decided during the 1950s that they were going to disobey these laws. That what they would do was to organize demonstrations where a bunch of people would gather and they'd make a few speeches and sing a few songs, and then they would all burn their passes. Active civil disobedience. Peaceful. They weren't being violent about it. But they were saying to the government, they were trying to make a witness to the government, a testimony, that they were not satisfied with the situation and that they refused to go along with it. And they were going to disobey by way of burning their passes. Well, what happened during the 1950s was that as black people started trying to break the laws in order to get white attention, the government decided that this was lawlessness. And that above and beyond all else, we have to have law and order in the country. And so the government said, if we have a black population which is becoming lawless, we'll have to take action against them. And they began to pass more and more laws which gave the police powers to control blacks. For example, one fundamental Western human right, which we all value very much, is called the right of habeas corpus. How many people know? What's the right of habeas corpus?
It's the right of that if you're in jail, you have the right to take your case to court, that you have a right to a trial.
Yeah, that's part of it. It also says that you have the right, before the police throw you in jail, to be charged with a crime, okay, which is related to this thing of being taken to trial. That the police cannot come up here right now and cart me off and put me in jail unless they say we're arresting you and charging you with X, Y, and Z crime. Now, that's a protection. It says that the police have to have evidence that I've broken the law before they just cart me off. In South Africa, during the 1950s, the government said, well, we have this situation of lawlessness here, and maybe we're going to have to give the police a little bit more power. For example, we will give the police power to detain black people whom we suspect of political activity. They may not have broken any crime, but if we think that they are troublemakers, we give the police permission to put them in jail and hold them there for 48 hours. And what they would do was, a day or two before a new pass law demonstration was scheduled to take place, the police would swoop down and round up all the people who they thought were going to be organizing this demonstration and just hold them for 48 hours and then release them again. And that was a way of trying to control this lawlessness, or what the government saw to be lawlessness. Today in South Africa, to give you some idea of to what extent the country has evolved into a police state, today in South Africa, the government has held some of my friends for up to a year and a half without ever charging them with any crime. People are not charged with the crime. The police just come and take them in the middle of the night. They don't even have to tell anybody that they are holding this person. And they can hold them for a year and a half without ever charging them with any crime. Now, the fact that it's moved from 48 hours to a year and a half indicates some degree of the direction in which the government of South Africa is headed, a fascist direction of no human rights, at least not for blacks. A number of other laws were passed during the 1950s which tried to control this growing unrest. And one of the laws was to ban the Communist Party of South Africa. There was Communist Party in South Africa, which was run by whites, radical whites. Blacks didn't get very involved with it. I don't think communism will ever make much progress in Africa, because the African people are too theistic in their orientation, and they know that communism in the Soviet Union is an atheistic doctrine, and you talk to an African about how some Americans call themselves atheists, and an African just can't even imagine what an atheist would be, because they're so highly theistic in their orientation. Anyway, the Communist Party of South Africa did not really attract many blacks. It was mainly a radical white organization, and the government made it illegal, banned it. Now, when they did that, these white communists had to find a new place to carry out their politics. And what they did was decide that they would go and join the ANC, the African National Congress back here, which was organizing these civil disobedience campaigns. Because the ANC, the policy of the ANC was always that blacks and whites should be working together for change. That any whites who were critical of the system could work with the black people to try and seek changes. And so radical whites were welcome to come in and join the organization. Now, those white communists came into the ANC at the same time that the government was attacking the leadership of the ANC by putting people in jail, and they brought some people to trial who were eventually acquitted, but it took 2 years for the trial to be conducted, and in the course of 2 years, 150 leaders, they prosecuted 150 leaders at once, and it took them 2 years to do that. And during the 2 years that they were on trial, they were removed from any kind of political activity. So that the leadership of the ANC was kind of silenced by government action at the same time that white communists were coming into the ANC. And very quickly, the white communists kind of gained, some people feel that they gained control of the ANC. I'm simplifying here a little bit for purposes of getting through a complex issue, but I think it's fair to say that during the 1950s, the ANC was infiltrated by disproportionate influence from radical white communists. And this caused some of the African people to be concerned about the ANC. And so in 1959, you had the formation of a breakaway movement called the Pan-Africanist Congress, the PAC. I mentioned this organization because today the two main guerrilla movements are the ANC and the PAC. And I'm trying to cite where some of the historical beginnings of this movement come from. The PAC was formed in 1959 as an all-black liberation movement, because the experience of people in the ANC was that where you open yourself to working with whites, you get some radical white communists who, that's really not what we want to be about. So they said, let's form an all-black movement. It was led by some very strong African Christians. The PAC had a very brief life of only 1 year. And during that time, they formed, they were leading pass law demonstrations and trying to organize some strikes in the country, and were rapidly gaining a lot of members and becoming a very prominent organization. Yesterday morning, I talked about African Christianity, the independent churches. And it's significant to note, for those of you who are here for that presentation, that one of the prime areas of focus for the PAC was among the African independent churches. Because here were a group of people who were working as blacks together. And they were attracted to this now political philosophy that blacks should try and seek change on their own. Well, early in 1960, March 21st, 1960, the PAC announced that it would begin a new wave of pass law demonstrations. And this was another wave of activity that the PAC was responsible for. But the government decided at that point that this civil disobedience movement of the 1950s was getting a little bit out of hand, that too many blacks were getting involved in this, and it was creating too much publicity, which was causing whites to become fearful that maybe there was going to be black unrest. And so the police decided they better try out a new tactic aimed at controlling this black unrest. And on March 21st, 1960, when about 3,000 Africans gathered at a place called Sharpeville to engage in a peaceful demonstration against the passes, they made speeches, sang songs, and then burned their passes. After they burned their passes, they turned to the police station where they had gathered in front of them, and they said, okay, arrest us. We're prepared to go to jail now, and we want to show you how deeply we reject these laws. Well, the government decided that it was necessary to use new tactics to control these movements, and so what they did was to open fire on the crowd with machine guns, killing 69 Africans and wounding about 180 others. Most of the people who were shot by the police that day were shot in the back as they tried to run away from the police. As the police began firing, the crowd panicked, they began to scatter, and the police continued to fire to the point where most of the people who were shot in the back. Immediately after that occasion, well, on the same day, after the news had begun to spread around the country that this is what had happened, police opened fire on several other crowds in other places who were also engaged in peaceful protests. A few weeks later, the government banned the ANC and the PAC, declared them to be illegal organizations that were causing too much trouble, and said no longer can these organizations be allowed to operate in South Africa. So the 1960 was a watershed year of crackdown, government crackdown against organizations which had been committed to working for peaceful, although no longer legal, activity. I think it's good that Americans these days increasingly give some attention to the growing movement of protest in South Africa. But I think a typical kind of knee-jerk reaction for us is to condemn anyone who uses guns and to tell people that that's not the right way of seeking change. Now, I can share with you my own personal experience that if you say to an African that it's wrong for them to be taking up arms to seek change in their situation, that it becomes very embarrassing when that same African responds by saying, do you know what our 50-year history of trying to seek change without guns resulted in? In other words, our criticism that they use guns gets nowhere with Africans if we don't first know about the history of how they tried to work without guns. In fact, they see our criticism as being very naive, and they laugh at us for it, and they reject it totally. And indeed, I think we owe it to African people whom we want to give advice to about peaceful methods of seeking change to first study their own history of trying to work without guns before we condemn their taking up guns. And this is not that study. This is just a thumbnail sketch of a 50-year period that it would be good for us to look at before we condemn the usage of guns. That's not the end of the story, thank God. How many people recognize the name of a man named Steve Biko? B-I-K-O. One, two, three. Biko was, maybe if I remind you a little more people will recognize. About 2.5 years ago, there was a lot of publicity in our newspapers about a black man in South Africa who had been found dead in a police cell. Yeah, now a few more remember his name. Steve Biko was his name. In 1960, Steve Biko was 12 years old. 12-year-old kid at this point of government crackdown. And growing up in an urban township in South Africa in 1960, you can imagine that he would have had a sense of excitement about this growing protest movement of the 1960s. Of the 1950s. In the late 50s, he would have been just a young boy, and you can imagine a 12-year-old kid, if there was a protest march coming to town, he would have found that pretty exciting kind of an event. And just at the point that Biko was, entering adolescence, and would have been old enough now to actually march with these protesters, just at that point, there was this government crackdown, after which nothing happened. From 1960 to 1968 was a period in South Africa where really nothing happened in the way of above-ground political protest. You did have these organizations that were banned by the government, the ANC and the PAC in 1960, went outside of the country and began to organize as guerrillas, because they said, well, we tried to work legally, that didn't get us anywhere, so we tried to work illegally but peacefully, and the government ended up shooting at us and outlawing our organization. So the only option left to us is guerrilla warfare. And in 1960, those organizations left South Africa and they began training for guerrilla warfare. But inside the country, nothing happened. There was virtually no protest between 60 and 68. It was a dead period, a very depressing period to grow up in South Africa. And Biko, growing up during this period, has later written that this was a period which was characterized by a fear. Blacks in South Africa were scared that any sort of political protest was going to land them in prison or subject to torture or maybe even kill them. And so they better not get involved in politics. Even if the situation is wrong and unjust, they better leave politics alone because they were scared that any kind of political involvement would threaten them. Biko grew up, his teenage years were during this era of great fear. In 1966, 67, he went to university. He was studying to be a doctor. And he and his other young university friends, who were very idealistic, as students tend to be, said, we have to find, we have to give our people some new hope. Biko has written in this book of his writings that the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. He said, the most powerful tool that whites have is that they are controlling our minds. They have made us so scared of them that we'll take anything from them. And that control of our minds is the most powerful weapon they have. So Biko and his university's friends said, we have to set out on a movement which will recover our minds and recover this resource so that we will begin to see ourselves in a better light. Let me put it another way. As he and his university friends examined the history of black protests, they said up until 1960, the protest movement has always been aimed at one of the problems operating in South Africa, namely the problem of a white superiority complex. Whites think that they're superior, and this is creating a lot of problems for us. And all of the movements up until 1960 were always trying to change white attitudes, to convince whites that they were not so superior, and therefore they ought not be keeping all of the power and the privilege for themselves. But in 68, Biko says, maybe white superiority complex is only one of two problems that we've got operating here. As well as a white superiority complex, that is a real problem, and now the government has closed off all avenues except violence of changing white superiority complex. But maybe there's another problem in the country that some of us who aren't ready to engage in violence, maybe there's another problem we can work on. And that's the problem of a black inferiority complex, that we blacks have come to see ourselves as inferior. After 300 years of white supremacy, and whites running every organization that we ever use, we've started to think that maybe we need whites. For 300 years now, we've been educated in a system where whites totally control, and as a result of this, we've begun to see ourselves as inferior, because that's what whites have been teaching us all the time. So maybe a second problem that we can address ourselves to is the problem of a black inferiority complex. And in 68, Steve Biko started a movement which was designed, called the Black Consciousness Movement. I'll just call it BCM. Black Consciousness Movement, which said violence is dehumanizing. And black people in South Africa are already dehumanized by virtue of this inferiority, the sense of inferiority that we have. So maybe what we need to do, as well as having some people who go off and organize the guerrilla war, maybe there are other people, like Biko, who weren't ready to engage in that themselves, personally. And they said, there's another thing we can do, and that is to work on building up black consciousness, to give blacks, to help blacks overcome their sense of inferiority. And so they started a movement in 68, which was legal, peaceful, which operated above ground, which focused just on building up the black community. And the government at first thought, well, this is all right. The government was used to protest movements which were always trying to change whites, change white thinking. And the government had become very sensitive to the fact of stomping out any kind of movement which was trying to change white thinking. But they weren't used to this other kind of idea of black consciousness, of working on black thinking. So the government said, well, this can't be too dangerous. We'll let them go on. It started off as a students' movement. Biko was working with a group of multiracial students who were critical of the government and were trying to seek change and so forth, so on, white liberals. And he broke away from this group and formed a black movement, a black students' movement. Because he said, as long as we work under the leadership of whites, what sense does that make? He said, whites create the problem, and then they also try and tell us, other whites try and tell us how to solve the problem. And somewhere the black role is missing. So he said, let's us blacks go off by ourselves as black people, and we'll try and put together our idea of what kind of changes are necessary. I don't know if I'm talking too fast or what. You're not doing your job. You're supposed to help me out here with some questions and give me a chance to breathe once in a while. I hope that you remember that. It started off as a students' movement, but it very quickly spread into the community. SASO, South African Students Organization, was the first black consciousness movement organization in 1968. By the way, an interesting feature of SASO was that they decided that Christianity was very important to the black people, and that they wanted to work on developing black pride and black thinking in every sphere of life. So one of the projects of SASO was a black theology project. They said, whites have been teaching us what the Bible says all these years, but God speaks not only to whites, God also speaks to some of us black Christians, some of us who have been Christians for three or four generations, and we... well, at least two or three generations, and we also are spoken to God by the Bible, so we should be putting together, we should be thinking about the Bible by ourselves, and not just taking all of our ideas about Christianity from whites. And because Christianity was so important to so many of the black people, SASO organized a black theology project. They also helped to start an organization called Black Community Programs, BCP. And this is the organization whereby the black consciousness movement really spread into the black community. Let me say something here. The black consciousness movement is not the name of an organization. There has never been, until very recently, outside of South Africa, but inside of South Africa, there has never been an organization called the black consciousness movement. Rather, that is, there's a way of making this point. Let's spell it with small letters. Rather, this is a name which is given to kind of a philosophical umbrella of a lot of different organizations that all have the same philosophy, namely that black people, the most powerful thing they can be doing to change their situation is to work on changing their own consciousness, to recover that weapon which whites have been using, namely of controlling black minds, to recover that for black purposes. A second organization that got formed was Black Community Programs. Now, Black Community Programs said, as well as having a students' movement, we also need to be working in the community. So they set up an organization which would do things like sponsor a medical clinic, or a dressmaking project, or a leatherworking project, or conferences for black ministers, black Christian ministers, or a number of different types of things in the black community, which were sort of black self-help programs. For example, Zanpilo Medical Clinic. Zanpilo means we stand on our own. Zanpilo Medical Clinic was black designed, black built, black staffed, black run, black board of directors, from start to finish. It's a black project, which has two kinds of impacts on the black community. First of all, it's when a rural Khoisan mother brings her child, a rural black mother brings her child to use this clinic, she finds out for the first time in her life that she can get good medical care from black people. It's the first time this has ever happened. Up until now, every time she's had a sick child and she's gone to a hospital, she knows that at the top of that hospital somewhere, there are whites running it. And she just unconsciously starts to think that she needs the care of whites all the time to help her. And so when a white government says whites have to be in charge because they're the only ones who can really run a good country like this, she believes it, because the only kind of leaders she's ever seen are always whites. So one impact that Zanpilo Medical Clinic makes is that it shows black people that they can do things for themselves. And in fact, they can even do it a little bit better, because the black people at Zanpilo Medical Clinic spoke her language. She might not speak English or the other white language, Afrikaans. But when she comes to this medical clinic, the people are speaking her language, and she likes that. So that's one impact that BCP programs make. A second impact is that, if we talk about leadership, I don't think leaders are born. I don't believe in that concept of born leaders. Leaders are made by experience. You develop leadership skill if you have leadership experience. Now, some people develop the skills better with their experience than other people do. Maybe that's the born factor, I don't know. But there are no leaders without experience. And in the black community in South Africa, black people had been systematically denied leadership opportunities, with the result that Biko and his friends were saying, what if we got the chance to come to power tomorrow, would we be able to run this country? And they said, maybe what we better do is start working on getting some leadership experiences so that when the opportunity comes along to run the country, we will have a group of black people in the country who have experience at leading and will therefore develop some skills and will be able to do a good job of taking over. So two kinds of impacts that black community programs make. One was the witness to the black community that they could do things for themselves. And the second thing was accumulating leadership experience. Well, the movement spread. All kinds of organizations were formed, community projects and organizations of black ministers and students' organizations, one political party, organization of black journalists. In every sphere of life where black people were working, they tried to group themselves together and say, what can we do to teach ourselves a sense of dignity, of pride? How can we help ourselves to overcome the problem of fear, which is enslaving us?
Because we have to start showing black people. We have to interpret the Bible in such a way that we teach black people that it's a sin to allow themselves to be oppressed. Interesting. Usage of Christianity, not exactly the kind that the missionaries would have taught, but perhaps one which is quite consistent with the teachings of Jesus in the New Testament. What was the government's reaction to all of this? I said that initially the government had felt that, well, these people are working by themselves in the black community, and that's part of separate development, which is our idea as white government. We think all the races should be separate and work on their own and develop themselves separately. So these people want to go off and do that. Can't be honest. Well, of course, a few years down the road, the government started to realize, because they have all kinds of informers, and they send their spies into meetings and organizations and stuff, and they began to realize that this was a fairly radical group of people, that these people were developing themselves to run the country. And that's a very radical notion in South Africa, that black people should be running the country. So the government in 1972 decided that it would have to crack down against this movement. And it's interesting. Every time the government has tried to crack down against the Black Consciousness Movement, they so poorly understand the movement that what in fact they do is actually strengthen it rather than hurt it. For example, in 72, Biko was working with the Black Community Program in Durban. Durban is a major city in this part of the country here. And in March of 72, the government banned Biko. Now, for those of you who are new to the South Africa discussion, banning in South Africa is a thing that the government does to certain individuals which it doesn't like. And there's no trial involved or anything like that. It's just the police decide that if Mabel here is a dangerous person, they're going to ban her. And what they do is they give her some papers one day, and the papers say, for the next 5 years, you shall never be able to meet with more than one person at a time. So no group meetings.
Outside of your immediate family.
Outside of your immediate family. If you want to get together with your husband and your child at the same time, that's all right. It's no more than your immediate family. You can never be quoted in any newspaper because your ideas are dangerous. You can never publish anything yourself. You can never enter a building which has trade union offices. You can never enter a building where educational materials are being prepared. You can never leave the police district in which you live. And a whole host of other things. Banning is a way of trying to silence a person. Well, in 72, they Biko and a number of other people were banned. And Biko was told, now, part of your banning order is you have to go back here to King Williamstown, out in the middle of nowhere, a little town, which is your hometown, because we don't like you being in a major city here. You have to contact too many people. And they thought that by banning a core of people in Durban who were active in these movements, that they would be able to crush the movement. Well, all they ended up doing was spreading the movement. Because a guy like Biko, a fantastic organizer, and a guy with a lot of personal charisma, what he did was to go to King Williamstown and to open a new branch of Black Community Program. So instead of crushing the movement, they had helped spread it. A year later, when they realized what he had done, they said, well, we're amending your banning order now, and we're telling you that you can no longer have anything to do with Black Community Program. So what he did was, he turned the new branch of Black Community Program over to somebody else, and he started another organization. Every time the government has tried to crush this movement, all they've in effect done is spread. In 1976, some of you will remember from your newspapers, that a place called Soweto, Black township outside of Johannesburg, blew up. A massive uprising started in Soweto, and it spread to students all over the country. And a generation of youngsters began a protest which illustrated the success that the Black Consciousness Movement had achieved. Because in 76, when children were protesting, what they did was, day after day after day, they walked in front of guns. Now, from 60 to 68, nothing happened in the way of black protests because blacks were scared. By 1976, you had 13, 14, 15-year-old school kids who had so conquered their own fear that they were willing to, day after day after day, walk in front of police guns, armed with the top of a garbage can and a few rocks. I've seen a film about this uprising, which shows school children standing in the middle of the open here, picking up rocks and throwing them at the police. And all they got in the other arm is the top of a garbage can. Well, bullets go right through a garbage can. And you see him throwing these rocks at the police, and you see the guy playing, because he gets hit with a bullet. You hear the gunshot go off, and then he kind of flinches. And instead of running for cover because he's been hit with a bullet, he reaches down for another rock. And he keeps firing rocks, and he keeps getting hit by bullets until he drops dead to the ground. Now, the part of a 16-year-old kid, that takes a lot of courage. And could not have happened were it not for a movement which had taught black people to conquer their own fear. And taught them that it's better to stand up and speak what we believe to be the truth. Even if it kills us, it's better to do that than it is to go on living in a kind of half-human state, which is enslaved by our own fears. that black people in South Africa today believe that it will be necessary for a lot of them to make the sacrifice of their own personal life, but that ultimately it is better for them to sacrifice their lives today for the sake of a better future for their children than it is for them to accept the kind of injustice that they've been exposed to. Now, whites in South Africa and whites in Europe and the United States believe that this kind of thing can be controlled with guns. For example, the Minister of Justice in South Africa, or the equivalent in our country would be the Attorney General. In 1976, when the Soweto Uprising got started, he went in front of the public media and made a statement, I'll give you the direct quote, said, "The authority of the gun must be established in this situation. We have chaos, lawlessness, and we must demonstrate the authority of the gun." That demonstrates where white faith lies. It's kind of a chilling statement to hear in South Africa. Since that time, I've started to wonder if there's any parallel faith demonstrated by supporting the largest military budget in the world. Because we don't have the kind of guts, really, to sacrifice our life in favor of a better life for people that come after us, we are mistakenly led to believe that guns which threaten people's lives will keep them subdued. And a lot of our policy is based on that. But my own experience of the Black Consciousness Movement is that they have hit on a truth which in fact is very much rooted in the New Testament, that he who loses his life. Well, maybe you've already raised two issues that I want to respond to, so maybe while I make those two responses, the rest of the time to me. First of all, I think to say that passage implies laying down your life for the gospel according to Black South Africans is that it's a sin to allow yourself to be oppressed. And so, in fact, you know, this is the gospel that they lay down their lives for. Secondly, the people who are taking up guns, I believe, are not the most important force in South Africa. That's not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the Black Consciousness. Those are people who said violence is dehumanizing activity, and what black people need is a rehumanizing experience. So we're going to engage in the kind of activities which build up our humanity. Now that doesn't mean that they condemned the people who took up guns, because they said violence begets violence. And some of our people who have had their parents tortured to death have experienced a kind of violence which has planted seeds in their hearts that mean that they will respond violently. And those are the people who go out of the country and take up guns. If in 1976, when all these school children were being shot, a lot of school children who saw their friends shot by the police in the course of trying to carry out a peaceful march to the school administration offices got so angry that they said, you know, this is violence which has happened to us, and our only, you know, the response that's created is a desire to be violent. But I think the most important force in South Africa today, through this Black Consciousness Movement, are the part of people who have not taken that step of violence, but who are willing to walk, to expose themselves to white violence, who are willing to walk in front of white guns. And the more people that walk in front of white guns, the more people are going to get shot, the more people that get shot, the more people that are going to be ready to take up guns.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
It depends. I would say that, Biko's philosophy was, first of all, let's get clear about the military odds at stake here. The military of the South African government is more powerful than the military of every other African country combined. It is a highly potent military operation. And for that reason, I don't think that guerrilla warfare is ever going to topple the South African government. I think that guerrilla warfare is going to spread fear in the white community. that the more guerrilla strikes that happen, the more scared whites are going to get. And only after that white fear has started to grow are some whites going to start talking about negotiating for change.
That's how the whites work on the blacks, and now the blacks are, because, like you said, when was it, 68, everyone was so afraid they wouldn't do anything. They think that's what the blacks are not going to do.
Yeah, the whites, well, not completely the same thing. I mean, in 1960, the government paralyzed blacks with the display of force.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen now, I think, is that guerrilla strikes are going to show the whites that they have to negotiate. I mean, that's what happened in Rhodesia. You did not have a military takeover in Rhodesia. You had guerrilla warfare waged to the point where whites were willing to negotiate.
I'm thinking that there's that possibility. There's the other possibility that the whites will feel more cornered and be more receptive than ever before.
They will for a while, and that is their response at the moment. But more and more, as more and more white towns die, as more and more bombs go off in white urban centers, increasingly whites are going to say, how in the world can we end this? And Biko says, at that point, whites are going to be open to negotiation. And it will be important that there be a movement within the country which has so developed black dignity and black pride that the whites will have somebody to go. Well, for one thing, I think in both of the situations you mentioned, you don't face the same kind of odds within a given country that you do in South Africa, so that the analogy breaks down somewhat there in terms of how long it will take.
Well, yeah.
But now on your question of how long it will take, Biko's response was that you can't anticipate that because it's such a complex web of factors. He says one factor working is it'll depend on how long Western nations continue to support whites. And that is always a factor. If the West ever starts to withdraw its support from whites in South Africa, then that is going to hasten the process of getting whites to negotiate. Now you tell me, how long is it going to be before the United States stops supporting white South Africa? I don't know. That really depends on us to a certain degree.
But I mean, like, you know, I think Rhodesia or Zimbabwe, and it seems like from 1966 now there was the UN sanctions and everything, and it took 14 years before finally that, you know, if they were able to put together enough courage and the public became aware enough of the problem that they were, of course, their government to, of course, Ian Smith.
Yeah, well, you had UN sanctions, but you did not have a cessation of Western support for Rhodesia. I mean, Mobil Oil, for example, continued, in spite of the UN sanctions, to supply Rhodesia with oil through South Africa, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So that I didn't mention UN sanctions. I said the withdrawal of Western support, meaning that even, you know, not just passing laws, but actually living up to those laws as well. I'm assuming both things would have an influence. And also the guerrilla war, it will depend on how that grows. Now last week they had their most effective strike thus far. $7.5 million damage, not a single loss of life.
Where was that?
In South Africa. They blew up the pride and joy of South African technology. South Africans have a lot of coal and they don't have any oil. Oil is their greatest weak spot. So what they've been doing is developing oil from coal technology. And that's a form of technology that the Americans would like to buy from them right now. These are called SOCO projects, the oil from coal technology. And they, in three different places, they planted bombs in some SOCO offices, in a refining plant, and in a fuel tank. Now, of the three bombs, only two went off. One failed to ignite the tank, but one bomb went off successfully and cost $7.5 million. Didn't kill anybody. And psychologically, it was important in the sense that it struck at the heart of South African white pride. I mean, white South Africans are very proud of this highly advanced technology that they have going. You know, struck at the heart of that. Anyway, the guerrilla war in the last year has been growing steadily. in February, they took some prisoners in a white bank for a while, and a couple of whites died there. And they took hostages in a white bank and demanded the release of an ANC leader who was jailed in 1916, who is still alive, Nelson Mandela.
In the Rhodesia, of course, you know, there was quite a big war over there. I mean, it was revolution, whatever they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Is the situation any better now than it was before?
Well, I mean, I think a month after the change, it would be impossible that it could have improved within a month. I mean, you know, nobody can do much in a country within a month. Although I suppose people would say it's better because the war has slowed down considerably. You're still having an occasional death, but you are having dozens of people dying every day in Rhodesia as a result of the war. And that has largely come to a stop. And the amount of money necessary to fuel the war can now be directed at some other parts of the country. Now maybe your question is aimed more at, is the country going to be better off in 5 years' time than it was, you know, after blacks have had a chance to work for a while? Is there really going to be progress? I believe so, just because it was an inevitable process. You cannot keep a majority down forever. And the sooner you get that reversal over with, the better off you'll be. Now whites are going to say, whites will say, we're the only ones who can run the country, and if blacks try and take over, there's going to be a lot of chaos. So we'll get out. Now when whites leave, that in fact creates a situation of chaos. Because whites have been running all of the factories, they've been running everything. And if they suddenly all leave, the country is much worse off, in a way. And that creates a lot of problems. So that what's going to happen in Rhodesia depends a lot on the degree to which whites are going to be willing to cooperate now. And the new black government in Rhodesia has demonstrated a strong desire to say to the whites, you know, we want you to stay, we want you to consider yourself equal citizens with us. We don't want to discriminate against you as a minority. And thus far, most of the white population has stayed. Now, how long they stay, you know, that's another question. And if they leave before black people get trained to run some of these things, then the economy could fall apart. I think that they're going to stay, because I think whites in Rhodesia recognize that they've got a tremendous future under a black government. That the possibilities for economic development in that country are fantastic under a black government. And I think that in some of the white newspapers in Salisbury, for example, were starting to publish editorials about that right after the change, saying, well, now we can trade with African countries that have been boycotting us. And we have more start toward industrialization than any of those other African countries, so that gives us an advantage. And we can become highly rich, an industrially wealthy nation if we all pitch together as Rhodesians and work now as Zimbabwe.
How is, maybe you don't want to go off in this direction, but I'm wondering how dependent Zimbabwe is on South Africa, being landlocked and their main rail links for the sea being through South Africa, or is that no more?
Well, I would not say
Mozambique.
I would not say that the main rail links are through South Africa. Now, traditionally, the economy in all of Southern Africa has been dominated by South Africa. You're right to suggest that. Something like that. So here is Mozambique. And right here is a major port, Maputo, which is a major water port. South Africa's ports are here and here. Rhodesia is located here. Now, traditionally, the economy in Southern Africa has always come up this way. Okay? But increasingly, as these buffer states begin to get independent, the economy is going to go much more this way. For example, Rhodesia can use this port. And Rhodesia is going to develop a lot of rail and communication links through Mozambique, freeing itself from South Africa. Let's, as is custom in the village, let's just pause for 60 seconds or so and join the rest of the village in prayer. Well, does that answer your question about
Yeah.
Of Rhodesia? And I think by now there are still certain trade links, obviously, with South Africa. But increasingly there's going to be an effort to become independent of South Africa. For both Mozambique is also dependent on South Africa at the moment. But they want to create more and more independency economically from South Africa. And once they become economically independent, then I think you're going to see them go to war against South Africa in the form of sponsoring guerrillas and that kind of thing.
Even if the blacks do take over the government, it seems to me like still for quite a while, and maybe even, I don't know, but the whites are still going to be the main force because they have the technology. And I don't think there's any really great fear for the whites.
What about bloodbath?
Well, that is the great fear, that there would be a backlash against them. Now, in fact, I think that's unfounded. There isn't evidence for that in other African countries where blacks have come to power. Also, my experience of blacks is that they have, as a culture, I talked about this on Saturday, I did a presentation on African culture, some of the cultural strengths of Africans, and one of them, I believe very deeply, is a capacity for forgiveness that we as Westerners can't even imagine. And I'm not being just romantic here. Many people talk and write about this, that Africans, as part of their culture, have an ability where there is repentance, and that's the crucial thing, whether or not we'll repent. Where there is repentance, Africans have an ability to put the matter behind them and to work together, to go on from that point on. Now, Steve Biko said to me at one point, I knew the man, which I'll say more about Friday night. He said to me at one point that he never wanted to kick whites out of South Africa, that he had too much appreciation for what whites had brought to Southern Africa, that all he was asking for now was the chance to show whites that just as he had learned a lot from them, likewise, they could learn something from him. And so he was just asking for the opportunity to participate in the society with whites, not to exploit them or kick them out of the country. So I think that although whites are fearing a backlash and a bloodbath, that's very true, I don't think it would materialize. Another thing which they unconsciously fear is the loss of their privilege. I mean, having a servant that only cost you $40 a month, full-time servants for $40 a month, you can get used to that pretty fast. Not doing the dishes, not doing any kind of cooking chores that you don't particularly like to, not having to do any house cleaning, never make your bed, leave everything around, leave it lay wherever you want to, and always have a nice, neatly kept home. You can get used to that real fast. And maybe if there were a black government in power, that black government might feel that one of the things they wanted to do was to set a minimum wage law for servants, so that the people who worked as servants made enough money to keep their children from starving. Infant mortality rate on the part of blacks in the rural areas in South Africa is 50% under the age of 5. You mothers, imagine half of your children being dead by the age of 5. That's one of the factors which returns, that's one of the consequences of the low pay to African workers, which results in such high profits to American
Those are tribal mothers in there.
Pardon me?
Well, aren't tribal mothers then? These are mothers that work in the cities, or the white cities?
Well, it would be both. I'm not sure what I understand.
Well, I figured maybe they were just the nomads or something like that, or the tribes.
No, the people who live in the rural areas and who did not experience this kind of infant mortality rate prior to becoming to the white. But after whites have come and conditions have become so bad and poverty has become so desperate that that's the situation today. Now, certainly a black government is going to have it in mind to spread the wealth out a little bit. Well, if you've got a small class, 20% of highly wealthy people, and an 80% majority that is pretty poor, and the government comes to power to try and do something about that, that's going to
affect the land reforms and
white.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. But, I mean, you're also right to say that whites, with all of the skills and the technology and so forth that they have, are gonna continue to have a better deal than the average black. They might not have as good of a deal as they got at the moment, but they're going to continue to be fairly well off. The thing is not going to change overnight, and no one was stronger about that than Biko. I mean, Biko said what we need is an evolutionary change. And the degree to which he said he wasn't about to try and change the whole system overnight. He said we've got a capitalist system. We think it's accomplished certain things, but it's also got some problems with it. But basically that's the system we've got, and if we were to take power tomorrow, we would try and gradually evolve it in some new direction. We would not try and wipe the slate clean overnight.
Would you define it as an evolutionary
socialism?
So
I wouldn't give them a label. Mm-hmm. But, that's maybe not a bad label. If you want to give them a label, that's
but
maybe not a bad
one.
But
he was just a group. I mean,
he wasn't a capitalist, he wasn't a communist. He told me that he put Moscow and Washington in the same camp. So both of them got their own interests at heart. Both of them are imperialists. They're trying to control us for their own benefit. Neither one really wants to see a strong, independent Africa emerge. And nothing would lead to an independent Africa quicker than allowing blacks to come to power in South Africa, because South Africa is the only industrialized nation on the whole continent. And what would it mean if other African nations could start trading with South Africa to get automobiles and this kind of thing? It would hurt our economy, but it would certainly strengthen Africa. And I'm concerned that, as these questions focus more and more for us in the next few years, the kind of information that we get and upon which we base our information and our judgments, our opinions, is going to be so biased by our own national interests. I mean, think about the popularity of a guy like Reagan today and the degree to which Reagan is right out front with his opinion that American national interest is most important, paramount. I think that one of our basic problems, most of you are new, so I'll push something that I've been pushing all week long, the last week too. I think one of our basic problems is that most of the information that we know about Africa comes from a media system which is owned by the businesses that are benefiting from Africa. And now, we don't get much information from that media, but we do get a little bit. It focuses on the Idi Amin and all of the kind of savagery about Africa. So I think it's desperately important that if we want to be faithful in relation to a larger view of the world, and as Christians we have a call to make as our Lord, not as somebody we friendly respect, but as our Lord, the body of Christ. And that body of Christ is rapidly becoming more and more African. So maybe we ought to try and find alternative ways of learning about Africa so that we can be faithful in relation to them. And this is a little weekly publication that takes me about 20-25 minutes a week to read. No editorials, nobody trying to tell me what opinions I should have about Africa. Just facts. Once a week comes out full of good factual information on what's happening in Africa. And I think I don't think I can teach anybody what they need to know about Africa, but I think maybe I can stimulate some people to be concerned that maybe we need to start giving some attention to Africa. And if you're at that point, then I strongly recommend that you consider subscribing to this. Even if you've never cared anything about Africa before in your past, several people who've never had an interest in Africa have, after spending some time with me, decided to subscribe, and what they tell me is that, well, for the first month or two I was reading this, trying to read it, and it was awful confusing. All kinds of new names and places and stuff I didn't understand. But I stuck with it, and after about 2 months, I kind of got caught into their cycle of reporting, and it started to fall into place. It started to make sense, and I started to understand what I was reading. And now, every week when it comes, I sit down and read it immediately, because I'm so excited to see what else I'm going to learn. It's written for the average American who doesn't know much about Africa but wants to start learning.
How much does it cost?
Well, it costs $25 a year to subscribe, which isn't bad for a weekly publication. Also, if you take this brochure, you can get an introductory one-year subscription for $16.50. There are rates published in here which have gone up since this brochure was published, but these people know what I'm doing and how strongly I promote them. I don't get, you know, I don't have any commercial relationship with them. Don't think that I make a commission on a sale or anything like that. I do it because I think it's the single best way for us to engage in more of a faithful relationship with a place like Africa, which, I mean, to be honest with you, I don't think black South Africans are saying anything to white South Africans. That the whole third world isn't trying to say to the whole United States. And maybe we need to open ourselves up to that third world, not by reading our newspapers, which are owned by the businesses who are threatened by a third world demand, but to open ourselves up to a different media system. This one was started with seed money from church denominations who agreed that maybe part of a concept of mission is, you know, knowing more about each other. And so they put this together, and it's not, you know, it's not written just in church languages. They have articles on churches once in a while, but it's basically a secular, objective look at Africa. And they're doing such a good job, by the way, that African newspapers are starting to subscribe to Durham, North Carolina, to get information about other parts of Africa, which is interesting. Barb?
Well, I have a question about how evolutionary change would be possible, why it could happen in a country like South Africa, but maybe wasn't possible in Cuba or China or Cambodia or, you know, just about any other country that had such a change in government structure. Would it be because South Africa is industrialized, or why do you think it would be possible to go by incremental change?
I mean, well, you're talking about a question of degree. You know, I mean, evolutionary versus revolutionary, it's not two different things, it's actually two ends of the same continuum.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about degree. And I think the basic factor there is the attitude of the people who take power. And we may have a revolution in South Africa. If people like the Black Consciousness Movement are continually ignored, and by the way, they've been looking, they couldn't figure out why American Christians didn't take more of an interest in them, because they really felt that being mainly a group of Christians themselves, that they were operating according to Christian principles, and they just expected that we would have more of an interest in them. And what they don't maybe understand is that we never heard about it. But anyway, if they're not allowed to get power eventually, maybe it would be more of a revolutionary situation. I think it depends on the mentality of the people. Now, I would suspect that people like Biko would say the reason change might come, you know, the reason we might prefer change to come more evolutionarily in South Africa than, say, in Cuba, is because in South Africa you still got, and even if blacks come to power, you still got that 20% of the population, which includes all of your skilled personnel. Whereas in Cuba, when new people came to power, the old elite left the country real fast. So it was like you didn't have the same kind of, it was also not an industrialized country, but you didn't have the momentum of the old institutions to keep intact. So, I mean, you didn't have much of a slate to erase to start over with. Now, Cuba's not my field. Maybe I'm way off base here, but I would just think that in South Africa, you know, all of your technical and skilled personnel, as well as all of these huge industrial infrastructures, is that black South Africans see it as a strength. They don't want to have to start importing automobiles just because they're starting to run the country. I mean, they're manufacturing automobiles in South Africa right now, and they think that's a plus. And they want to be able to continue manufacturing automobiles, and they say, maybe we'll have to, you know, continue the kind of economic system we've got for a while. What Biko said he would do is take one industry, the mining industry, and nationalize that immediately. Because he said, here, this is coming out of the ground. It's our sweat and blood that's taking that stuff out of the ground. It's not the importing of foreign technology, all that kind of thing. So we can make a case that this is ours. And we'll nationalize one industry straight away, leave all the others alone, and work with that one industry which we've nationalized to try and set it up on a more African economic pattern, not so much on a Western economic pattern. And once we've spent 5 or 10 years doing that, and we've developed some new principles of how to run an industry that we think, you know, on the basis of mistakes we've made and new insights we've learned, then we'll hold this up as an example, and we'll say to Ford, General Motors, and the other multinationals operating here, here's an example of how some good changes can be made, and then expect them to follow suit. So that down the road somewhere, the multinationals might be challenged to, you know, to make some changes, to leave more of the profits in the country, that sort of thing.